This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with Charlie Baker's effort and stumble to woo women voters.
Democrats are saying they just put it on an email a couple of minutes
ago. Okay, it's going to be the last one, sweetheart.
It's the last one. Sweetheart.
I'm kidding.
Also, the president goes to New York to the UN climate summit as hundreds of thousands of protesters demand action on global warming.
Climate is changing faster than our efforts to address it. The alarm bells keep ringing.
So what can especially vulnerable cities like Boston do against the rising tide?
Plus, get ready for a whole new skyline as Boston approves a slew of new buildings.
And after 20 years in the business, Derek Jeter goes out on top.
Base hit to right field. Here comes Richardson. Here's the throw from Markakis. Richardson is safe. Derek Jeter ends his final game with a walk-off single.
And a day after that, he says goodbye to his fans in the Bronx. Jeter brings his farewell tour to Boston.
Well, joining us now for more on these stories and the rest of the week in the news is John Carroll, professor at Boston University's School of Communications and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog. Hi there, John.
Hi, Meghna.
Also with us is former city councilor and Globe columnist Tom Keene. Welcome back, Tom. Good to see you.
It's good to see you, honey.
Okay, we'll get there in a minute.
Honey!
So we're going to start off with a checkup on the governor's race, as if you guys didn't know. A contest that will likely be determined by the women's vote. So the Democrat Attorney General Martha Coakley has been airing ads like this.
She's been a powerful advocate for women and kids, and one of the toughest opponents Wall Street and the big banks have ever seen. Now Martha Coakley is running for governor with a plan to build an economy that works for everyone.
And here's Republican Charlie Baker. He's running an ad with his daughter, touting his support for reproductive rights.
You're totally pro-choice and bipartisan.
Bipartisan leadership's what we need on Beacon Hill. We can make Massachusetts great and create jobs.
And that focus on getting women's support is what made Baker's off-the-cuff comment to Fox 25 political reporter Sharman Sacchetti so surprising. So here's that report.
His commercials featuring his daughter and his wife target women. Monday, Baker did shake up his campaign by changing out the firm that runs his media strategy. He says it was just over a disagreement. When I tried asking one last question about how Democrats believe it could mean the start of negative ads, here's what Baker said to me.
Democrats are saying they just put it on an email a couple of minutes
ago. Okay, it's going to be the last one, sweetheart.
It's the last one. Sweetheart.
I'm kidding.
All right, sweetheart. So Baker quickly apologized, and later this week, a new poll from WBUR finds Baker trailing Coakley by 10 points overall. So, Tom Keene, let me start with you. How big a gaffe was this?
I think it was a big gaffe, and what I haven't figured out yet is how long, how much that has in the way of legs. I mean, we've got a couple of months, you know, a month and a half until the election. Does it actually have an impact on the election, or does it end up being forgotten? I will tell you that right now I've heard the word sweetheart more over the last 24 hours than in my entire life. This has become, this is a viral kind of thing that is spreading everywhere. And if Baker gets tagged with it, I can really see it hurting him.
Hmm. What do you think, John?
Well, I'm not sure it has legs. I think it has gams, actually. Seriously, though, I think Martha Coakley may have lucked into an opponent who is more tin-eared and more ham-handed than she's been. I think Charlie Baker is trying to be a regular guy. Regular guys walk into diners and say, "Hey, sweetheart, how you doing today?" I mean, that's part of, I think, what was going on there. If I were Sharman Sacchetti of Fox 25 News, I'd be a lot more upset that he called me his friend than that he called me sweetheart.
In his
apology,
he
said, she's a good reporter and a good friend. That would bother me a lot more, I think, than the other comment.
You know, I was following a bunch of the Twitter traffic on this after the story broke, and I was surprised by how many people, or at least a few anyway, suggested that too much is being made of it. One person said sweetheart was used in the same way that someone might have jokingly said to a guy, "Hey, dude, you know, let's cut it out." Is there anything to the argument that too much is being made of this, Tom?
Oh, I think yes. I mean, I don't think that this really indicates that Charlie Baker, what his policy positions are going to be, or that somehow he's lying when he talks about his, you know, his support of, say, that he's pro-choice. I don't think this undercuts that all in the substantive sense. And I think maybe that's what people are reacting to, that it's just, you know, it just went past the censor in his mind and somehow got out there. But it really doesn't mean much beyond that. And Baker does make a very good case that in his past career, he has worked in a very professional capacity with very senior level women. And certainly I haven't heard any of them coming out and saying, no, that's not true. He really just demeaned all of us.
Yeah.
I think this may be the fatigue with the Umbridge industrial complex. I mean, this whole idea of, you know, zero to outrage in 8.6 seconds, it gets tiring after a while. It's clearly political. It's clearly something that they're trying to inflate to take political advantage of. And I think the public may be looking at this and thinking, you know, enough with this. I just want to add that a Globe poll that came out today had Charlie Baker up by two. Mm-hmm. So this race seems anyway to be entirely up for grabs. There's a lot of race left. And I think the sweetheart comment is going to be a footnote at best when this race is over.
John, I'm curious about what you make of this change in the Baker media team. In fact, that's what reporter Carmen Sarchetti was trying to ask about. Do you think that negative ads might be on the way? Is it notable in any other way? I mean, what's your response?
I'd be surprised if Charlie Baker's campaign starts producing negative ads. They've got all these super PACs that can do it for them, who are doing it for them at this point, going after Martha Coakley because she didn't know what the state gas tax was. That kind of thing. I think the split that we're seeing across the country is the super PACs do the dirty work and the candidates do the positive stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I would be surprised. I think it's not that he's going to negative ads. I think he's going to go and try to get to better ads, because the ad, all due respect to his daughter, who seems to be a bright young woman, that's about the most awkward conversation I've seen since my folks did the birds and the bees with me. So you know, I think maybe
you
he just
wouldn't want to run for office on that one.
I sure wouldn't. But I think he's just looking for better ads.
Well, as the lone woman in the studio right now, if I might say, cutie pie beefcake, shall we move on to something more substantive?
You bet, huh?
That was just for the Umbridge Industrial Complex, so... Fire away. Let's talk about climate change, because this week in New York, the United Nations met to discuss action over climate change, or the lack of it. President Obama spoke, and hundreds of thousands of protesters marched in the streets. And while there might be some pretty significant inaction on the international level or even the national level, obviously cities like Boston are poised to change dramatically as climate change continues unabated. So we've got a little bit of tape here from Brian Sweat. He's chief of environment and energy at Boston City Hall. He described the coming threat to Boston earlier this year. He says a rise in sea level is costly, but it's also the heat waves that come with climate change that could take far more lives. He says they already take more American lives than all other natural hazards combined.
24 days a year above 100 degrees Fahrenheit is a fundamentally different climate in New England than we have today. And it is a climate, frankly, that we are not prepared for from a building perspective, from an infrastructure perspective, or from a neighborhood perspective. And that is within the lifetime of folks who are with us today, right? That is within the current generation of kids that are in elementary school today.
So that's Brian Sweat, chief of environment and energy for the city of Boston. Tom Keene, let me start with you. The reason why we wanted to talk about this today in the context of our regional week in review is that there's got to be place or room for cities like Boston to take climate change seriously and do something at the local level to protect the city.
Right. And Brian, I'm pretty familiar with Brian, and I've actually seen some of the stuff they've been putting together. And there are a lot of things that we can do. I mean, first of all, it's regrettable we have to recognize that it will occur, that you know the nations of the world are not going to get together and solve this problem in any kind of fashion that reduces the risk we face, and we will be facing this risk. You're going to have rising seas, which means that you need to start taking electrical equipment and so on and putting it on the roof rather than down in a basement, because that would flood and wipe out a building. What we'll have to do is start behaving in terms of housing and so on and with our schools the same way they do down south, which is that we're going to have air conditioners and everything. You're not going to be able to, you know, New England buildings get away with just a couple of hot days a year, so we don't air condition our schools for the most part. We don't air condition a lot of our housing. We're going to have to start to do that. It's going to be very different for us.
Well, and so, John, let me ask you, on besides doing all the local protection as much as we can here, I mean, is there room for cities like Boston to actually be leaders, setting an agenda that isn't getting set internationally?
Well, there's certainly room for that. By the way, can I put in my vote for Tom as climate change czar of Boston? There's certainly room for it. They haven't told me anything that they're doing. I'm not aware. I know there's a big dust up over the FEMA map and
the flood maps, right?
That would raise insurance rates significantly for people. But beyond that, I don't see a whole lot of activity. And it's interesting this protest that they had down in New York with the 400,000. There were a lot of students down there, and Drew Gilpin Faust, the president of Harvard, and John Hennessy, the president of Stanford, wrote a piece in the Huffington Post saying universities have a big role to play here. And I didn't understand two words that they said in it. I mean, it was all sort of, macro stuff, for one thing. And the other thing is universities aren't doing as much as they could be doing because they're tied into petroleum money in a lot of research ways. So who's going to step forward? That's the question. If the city of Boston can afford to step forward, that would be great. But I don't think they can do it on their own.
Well, interestingly, on that note, it wasn't all that long ago that David Swenson, who manages Yale's endowment, sent a letter to some movers and shakers there saying they ought to consider, not necessarily for political reasons, but for economic reasons, possibly divesting from some of those very companies you talked about. But let me just ask you guys both one more question about the protests, because you mentioned those, John. There were 400,000 people who took to the streets in New York in advance of the UN climate summit. And this week, we also spoke with Hari Han. She's a climate activist and professor of political science at Wellesley, about the significance of those 400,000 in the streets.
The first time Bill McKibben tried to organize a climate rally was about 8 years ago, and he had about 1,000 people out there. And the news stories after that rally 8 years ago was, hey, this is the biggest climate march we've had in the United States ever. And so the question really is, how do they get from 1,000 people to 400,000 people in 8 years? And really what a lot of these organizations were doing is they were saying, how can we make people realize that the actions that they take can make a difference?
So from 1,000 to 400,000, that's quite a lot. It's not millions per se. But Tom, I mean, what's your thought on that? Do you think that the numbers we're seeing of people in the street who are protesting against a lack of action on climate change is significant?
So I wrote a piece about climate change a couple weeks ago, and the thing that amazed me was the response I got from the people who simply said, I was wrong, there's no such thing as climate change. The UN report, which is what I was referring to in my column, was just some giant conspiracy that's out there. And regrettably, while you have 400,000 people out there, the Republican Party, which currently controls the House and may control the Senate, does not believe that there really is climate change going on. And I think it's great to see people protesting and so on, but until that actually gets translated into the votes we have for the politicians in Congress, it's not going to matter much.
John?
I think one of the differences with this group here, the 400,000, is the tone of it. I think it's a lot more militant. The message seemed to be that we're pretty much fed up with the UN summits that have a lot of vague commitments and empty promises and don't really do anything. And what they're looking for is some kind of radical change at this point. So I think that may be a harbinger of sort of a different atmosphere that this debate will be operating under.
Interesting thing, though, about those 400,000 people. I heard someone say the other day, and it really stuck with me, this idea that 400,000 people from the grassroots, it wasn't a forum for political speeches. In other words, this was just like a ton of ordinary people sort of saying, the UN isn't doing it for us. The politicians aren't doing it for us. We're out here on the streets. So, I don't know. Interesting to see where that goes, but certainly unprecedented, the idea that 400,000 people would come together and there wouldn't be like a platform for a major political speech from somebody.
Right. And that's what you would like to see, which is this translate to some political action that actually gets different people elected.
Yeah.
Or does it become Occupy Wall Street? That's the other end of the spectrum.
Interesting. Well, so the seas are rising, and so is Boston's skyline. At least that's the plan. So this week, entrepreneur Steve Belkin said he's resurrecting a project to build a 740-foot glass skyscraper in the city's financial district. It would be the third tallest building in the city. First proposed back in 2006, it was shelved because of the financial crisis. Now plans are back, albeit I guess the building's going to be about 300 feet shorter than first proposed. But this is just one of a slew of projects that are underway in the city. The Globe on Wednesday called it one of the most active periods of construction in the city's history. There's approval for a pair of towers near the New England Aquarium, another at the edge of the Christian Science Plaza, another is going in a downtown crossing. So, what do we think? Tom, is this too much, too fast? Are we risking a bubble? What do you think?
So, carpe diem in this one. You have to seize the moment here. We went through a tremendous recession where we almost had negative building going on. People really see now financially that it's possible to put stuff in the ground. every developer is out there doing. And it's not only the ones you cited. You see this an enormous amount of residential development that's going on in the Seaport, also downtown, also in the Fenway. And I think it's great. Cities are places that should be dense and they should be high. That's really what defines a city, it seems to me. And that density is really what allows us as human beings to make a lot of connections with each other. And that's sort of the excitement of living in a city. You really have that ferment going on. So I'm a big fan of it. And where these buildings are being built is pretty much appropriate. I mean, there's a lot of debate about the one that might be next to the New England Aquarium because it's on the waterfront. But aside from that, it sort of fits in what people think of as the high spine of Boston. So I'm a fan.
John, I know you wrote about this a few times over the years on Campaigner Outsider. What do you think?
Well, I think it's no accident that this wave of development is coming in the wake of Tom Bonino's departure. I think that Tom Bonino was, in many ways, made it difficult for people to develop in Boston and specific people as well. So I think from that standpoint, it sort of opened a door for a whole new sort of era of development. I think one thing I want to just say is that this plan for the tower down in the Financial District, which was much larger in its previous incarnation. Also in its previous incarnation would have demolished 133 Federal Street, which is a building designed by Paul Rudolph, one of the great mid-century modern designers. The new development, the new plan, leaves it there. So I think that's a win for Boston in terms of retaining some of its history. It was the first modernist building in downtown Boston, built in 1960. So I think that's a good thing. And I think that it'll bring a whole new sort of entrepreneurial atmosphere to Boston, which is also good.
Yeah. So as a whole, I'm a big fan of this sort of boom in development. But let's also see a complementary boom in the development of affordable housing.
Here, here.
Well, and actually, to that point, mid-market housing.
Yeah.
That's really what's lacking in Boston.
Right, exactly, because we've got a lot of luxury units going up and some affordable housing, but for the vast people in the middle, the problem continues unabated. But anyway, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs today, and those are those stories that maybe weren't top of fold but deserve a mention anyway. So, John, can we start with you?
Sure. My hubbub comes from the Nieman Lab. Joshua Benton wrote a piece this week for Nieman Lab headlined, "Like it or not, native advertising is squarely inside the big news tent." And native advertising, just as a reminder, is sort of a chameleon of marketing. It sort of takes on the look of the editorial content around it so it blends into the surroundings. This had been pretty popular on BuzzFeed, Gawker, the kind of online publications that have been popular. Now, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, who else, The Guardian, all of them are taking native ads now, some of them labeling them more clearly than others.
Yeah.
Josh says, journalists can push for clear labeling and shame those who fall short, but otherwise they just have to keep their fingers crossed. I say readers can do the same thing. Readers have as much of a stake in this as anybody else.
As a user, can I block them?
No, you can't.
Darn.
Sorry.
Tom, your hubbub?
So my hubbub is the perils of being connected. We all think it's great that we are connected with each other and that we have become such a unified network nation. But the perils of that can be seen in a fire that occurred this morning, I believe, in Aurora, just Illinois, which is just outside of Chicago. It was a fire at an air traffic control facility, not even at the airport, that ended up basically shutting down air traffic across the country. And that's actually quite amazing. I mean, the connectedness is wonderful. But if you think about the fact that, you know, when people talk about hardening ourselves against disasters, even terrorist disasters, you actually need to have a degree of disconnectedness. Mm-hmm. And this really illustrates that example.
Wow. Well, can I just jump in here with my
hubbub? Please, go right ahead.
It's also transportation theme. That's what I wanted to do mine, although on a much lighter note. I got some sound associated with this hubbub, so let's listen to it. Okay, so that is sound from a video that was posted on Facebook, I believe, this week of a young person, a teenager, surfing on top of an MBTA Orange Line train as it's going pretty much at full speed.
Seriously.
Yeah. Or as a, and I think it appeared, it was dug up first by Boston Magazine, but Boston Inno calls it one individual's quest to pull off the most remarkably idiotic stunt ever tried on an Orange Line train. And I would completely agree with that, because this kid is up there on top of the train, it's going full speed, and you see in the video, he has to duck down suddenly as the train goes under a bridge, and then he does a handstand after that. I mean, it's so he might have gotten a thrill out of it, but he's lucky to be alive. And a lot of people have been reacting appropriately with consternation and negativity, saying, you know, maybe you ought to think of yourself, your family, and others next time you decide to surf on top of an Orange Line train. The MBTA, by the way, says it's close to identifying who it was, but do not try this at home or on a train.
This is all the fault of cell phone cameras.
Yeah, exactly.
If there weren't a cell phone camera, it never would have happened.
Exactly. So, so warning to all, surfing on the Orange Line, not a good idea.
All right. Well, here's my hubbub. I've got to sort of just tip my baseball fan hat to New York Yankees shortstop Derek Jeter, who, as most of us know, played his last game at Yankee Stadium last night and got the winning hit, of course, a walk-off single. So now this farewell tour comes to an end with the final three games of the season right here in Boston. And it's interesting to think about Jeter and how he will be greeted at Fenway, or said goodbye to at Fenway, because, of course, he was a great player who played for a team that Boston fans love to hate. And so I sort of like thinking about this, because it kind of puts Red Sox fans in a strange bind. Great as he was also the embodiment of so much pain that the Yankees have caused the Red Sox fans over the years. He was cool as a cucumber, but ruthlessly efficient at winning championships and often at beating the Red Sox. So here's a call, just so we won't forget, from a midsummer game in 2004, top of the 12th inning in Yankee Stadium, runners on second and third. The Red Sox are up, Trot Nixon at the plate. He hits a foul ball that curves toward the stands. Here we are.
1-2. He loops that to left field. Going to be a tough play. Jeter on the run, makes the play. Wow. And flies into the stands. Oh, what a play by Derek Jeter.
And a lot of us remember that, right? He emerged from the stands groggy with a bloodied face, but he had the ball. He beat us again. He beat us a lot. So we'll miss him not only as a great player, but as a great arch rival. Winning or losing mean the most, after all, against a worthy opponent. And that was certainly Derek Jeter.
Quick fun fact, he's not playing shortstop at Fenway this weekend. He's only designated hitting.
I'm a little bothered by that.
Wanted to leave on the Yankee dirt.
All right. John Carroll, professor at BU and author of the Campaign Outsider blog. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And Tom Keene, former city councilor, regular Globe columnist. Always great to have you here, Tom.
My pleasure.
Well, stick with us, listeners, because when we come back, we're actually going to talk about women's professional sports and why they don't get as much respect as the men. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.